Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. Sleep, once taken for granted, is something parents obsess about. From the endless quest to get children to sleep through the night, to worrying about how on earth we parents are going to get through the day on such little sleep. I know I speak for all parents when I say sleep is something we think about a lot. My guest today is so fascinated with sleep that his job centres around it. Professor Guy Leschiner is a consultant neurologist and professor of neurology and sleep medicine who's passionate about public education. The author of numerous books, he's presented radio and TV shows about the mysteries of sleep. Guy, thank you so much for joining me today. It's so brilliant to be able to talk about sleep. And I'd love to just start by understanding a bit more about sleep, because I don't actually know. Do we know why we sleep and what happens to our brains when we sleep?
We certainly have some insight into what happens to our brains during sleep. And we're beginning to understand the role of sleep in really regulating every aspect of our physical, mental, and importantly, neurological health. We know that sleep has a pretty much an impact on every aspect of our health, be that cardiovascular health, the regulation of our blood pressure, whether or not we eat huge amounts of food. But perhaps it, most importantly, it's involved in regulation and housekeeping of the brain in very broad terms.
So essentially what happens is that is there sort of sorting out that goes on while we sleep, that some of the memories are solidified and some of the memories are discarded, the ones that we don't need?
We certainly know that sleep is really important in memory consolidation. So in the electrical processes that result in moving memories from our short-term memory into our long-term memory, it's important in learning, and learning in a very broad sense. So not only learning of episodes in our lives, what we term episodic memory, but also in terms of a particular patterns of movement, how we walk, how we talk. It's also really important in terms of the housekeeping of the brain. So we know that, for example, in certain stages of sleep, there are channels within the brain that are termed the glymphatic system. And these channels open up in very deep sleep, in a stage of sleep called stage three or slow wave sleep. And that these channels are involved in the removal of certain toxins or metabolites from the brain. Essentially, these are the byproducts of being awake and our brains being active. One of those chemicals is actually fundamental to the development of conditions like Alzheimer's disease, which is why there is such a focus today on the association between sleep, or especially poor sleep, and the development of neurological disorders like dementia.
And how much sleep should we ideally get? I know that obviously babies and children need far more sleep, which presumably is associated with the fact that their brains are still developing. But as an adult, what's the optimum amount of sleep that we should be getting?
So that's a really difficult question to answer, because we know that our sleep requirement is a function of our genetics, but it's also a function of the quality of our sleep. So for some people, actually, there is good evidence, particularly if they carry particular genetic variants, that they need relatively less sleep than others. But for the population as a whole, there is really quite good epidemiological evidence, so looking at large-scale populations, that the optimal amount of sleep is somewhere in the region of between 7 and 8.5 hours. We know that things like mortality increases if you are sleeping less than, for example, 6 hours or more than about 9 hours. Some of that is probably related to the fact that, you know, many people who are ill anyway with other conditions may be on medications that actually alter their sleep or may have conditions that fundamentally influence their sleep. So it's not entirely clear, but certainly there's very good evidence that if you're sleeping less than on average 7 hours a night, for most people that will have negative health consequences.
And obviously we're talking to a cohort of people with young children who are probably quite regularly having less than 7 hours of sleep a night. Is this, you know, idea that we sleep less when we have young children, is it very detrimental to our health, or are our bodies kind of programmed to be able to deal with, you know, the best part of a decade of not very good sleep while our children are young?
Yeah, first of all, I can entirely sympathise, because I think that my sleep has never quite been the same since my kids were born. I think that we know that there are a number of mechanisms within the brain that allow us to adapt for sleep loss. So, for example, if somebody's particularly sleep deprived, provided that they haven't got other issues with their sleep, then what tends to happen is that the brain prioritises certain stages of sleep over others. So that stage of sleep that I talked about, that very deep stage of sleep during which this lymphatic system opens up, tends to be prioritized. So if people are very sleep restricted, then they potentially spend a much larger proportion of their night in that stage of sleep, which is thought to be most important for restoration and for things like tissue healing and growth. So there are some mechanisms in play. Undoubtedly, there are going to be some health consequences to being sleep deprived. Hopefully, most of those are short term rather than long term.
And can you catch up on sleep if you've had a sort of couple of years of bad sleep, or even let's say a week of bad sleep? You know what children are like. You know, they'll have a cold and then suddenly they're just not sleeping. How is it possible then to kind of catch up, or do we really need a sort of regular amount of sleep per night?
So there is this concept of sleep debt. So you can accrue a sleep debt by having your sleep disrupted for a prolonged period of time. There is quite good evidence that if your sleep debt is fairly low, then you can catch up within a couple of days. But actually, we know that, for example, if you take individuals and you sleep deprive them enough, you know, 4 hours a night, then actually even a weekend of catching up with your sleep, of being allowed to sleep for as long as you want, will not repair all the consequences of that sleep debt over two or three nights. And actually in a clinical setting, when we're trying to evaluate people for conditions like narcolepsy, let's say, then we typically say that it can take up to 2 weeks for the consequences of sleep deprivation to be reversed. And it's really important to understand that there are really differential consequences. So what I mean by that is that if you are very sleep deprived, there's obviously the sleepiness, the subjective feeling of wanting to go to sleep. But there is also the negative consequences on your cognition, on your ability to perform certain cognitive tasks. And we think that there are probably some genetic variants that influence how resistant you are to the effects of sleep deprivation on your feelings of sleepiness, but also on your cognition, and they may not necessarily match. So that there are probably some individuals who, for example, feel after a night or two that they are not sleepy anymore at all, but will still have those cognitive deficits that are part and parcel of sleep deprivation.
And how effective are sort of daytime naps if you've had a terrible sort of night's sleep? Are they good or bad, or do you need to be having a longer period of sleep for it to be truly restorative? I know that sometimes I've had a lunchtime nap and I wake up feeling even more exhausted than when I went to sleep.
Yeah, so this is a rather nuanced question, because I'm often asked this in the context of insomnia. So it's important to stress that insomnia is very different from sleep deprivation. Insomnia is the inability to sleep properly when you're given the opportunity, whereas sleep deprivation is really not having sufficient opportunity to sleep. So for insomnia, we generally tend to recommend people not to nap during the day, because it lessens the pressure on the brain to go to sleep at night and can actually engender poor sleep habits. If you're sleep deprived, then actually that is not necessarily applicable. A short nap, so 15 to 20 minutes, will lessen the sleepiness that you have as a result of sleep deprivation. A very long nap, so by long naps I'm talking about, you know, 1.5 to 2 or even 3 hours, means that you're actually going into the deeper stages of sleep in that nap, and you're really then fulfilling the requirements of sleep and may have additional benefits as well. And in cultures, for example, that have siestas, there's quite good evidence that a lunchtime nap has important impact on cognition, but also on wider health issues like lowering your blood pressure. So if you are very sleep deprived, then actually having a nap during the day is going to be rather useful. What you describe about waking up feeling even more tired after a daytime nap is often as a consequence of getting your timings a little bit wrong. Because if you go into the deeper stages of sleep and you try and wake up out of the deeper stages of sleep, people often experience something called sleep inertia or sleep drunkenness at its extreme. You know, that feeling of profound groggy headedness, of not being able to get going again after that daytime nap.
And what is the optimum time to sleep for a sort of lunchtime nap, daytime nap?
So we think that most people will tend to go into the deeper stages of sleep within about 20 to 30 minutes of sleep onset, which is why that if you're going to have a short nap, we tend to say limit it to 15 or 20 minutes to avoid waking up in that deep stage of sleep. And for most people, that first stage of very deep sleep tends to be over by about 90 minutes or so.
So either 15 minutes or 90 minutes, basically.
Yeah, or longer. I mean, obviously, there are huge differences between individuals, and it to some extent depends quite how bad the rest of your sleep is. But as a general rule, that's actually quite sensible.
And I speak to a lot of parents who are absolutely exhausted, but still find it very difficult to go to sleep. I think often as a new parent, there's suddenly so much to make you anxious. Your mind is spinning. I definitely had this. Is there such thing as sort of overtiredness that will prevent you from getting to sleep?
We know that many people have a trait called sleep reactivity. So this is something that many people will sympathize with, that, for example, issues in their environment will often impact on their sleep. So the typical picture of somebody in their youth is, you know, when they have exams or when they have a job interview or something like that, they know they're going to sleep rather poorly beforehand. And that trait, that sleep reactivity, is often associated with insomnia, you know, usually later on in life. And in insomnia, what tends to happen is that people enter into what's termed a hyperarousal state or a hypervigilant state, that feeling of being on high alert, which, of course, being a new parent is very good at engendering. You know, you're on high alert anyway because you're constantly worried about your baby. You know, you're constantly worried about whether or not they're too hot, they're too cold, they're sleeping, they're hungry, they're, you know, about to soil their nappy and you're going to have to get up to change it. So if you have that sleep reactivity trait in the background, then you're much more likely to enter into this pattern of, you know, essentially what you're describing is insomnia in the context of this hypervigilant state. And that hypervigilant state, it extends both from the psychological, so feeling on high alert psychologically. But we know that with significant sleep deprivation, there are hormonal changes that occur that fuel the insomnia. So levels of adrenaline, for example, go up, and adrenaline is the hormone that mediates that flight, fright, or fight response. And so essentially what you're describing is this sensation that a lot of people experience, which is feeling extremely tired but wired as well at the same time. So that jitteriness, that high alert feeling that people often describe.
In terms of if you're struggling then to get sleep as a new parent,
yeah,
is there anything you can do if you're feeling tired but wired?
Yeah.
Is there anything you can do to make sleep come a little bit more easily?
Yeah, so I think that we now know that for individuals with this tendency, and I think at its extreme, you know, in the absence of everything else going on, we would call this chronic insomnia. We know that there are obviously medications that can help, but really, over the last 20 years or so, we've moved very much away from medications because they have adverse effects. So they can make you feel very groggy. They can give you a hangover effect. They also have the potential for dependency, both psychological and, in some cases, physical dependency, and a phenomenon called habituation, whereby people require ever-increasing drugs or doses of drugs in order to achieve the same effect. The research of the last 20 or so years really points towards one particular technique, which is termed cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, as being the most effective long-term treatment in this kind of scenario. And cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is a but essentially a behavioral protocol to try and reprogram your brain to associate bed with sleep rather than bed with lying awake. Some parts of it are related to relaxation strategies. Other parts are related to essentially reconditioning your brain to associate your bed, the sleeping environment, with getting off to sleep rather than struggling to get off to sleep. And there are other aspects of it as well that all aim to reduce that hypervigilant, that hyperarousal state that you're describing.
Does distraction work? I always find listening to something on a sort of sleep timer when my mind is whirring is a sort of quite effective way of getting sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that is part and parcel of the CBTI protocol. Essentially, for many individuals, there is significant anxiety associated with sleep. So there's the anxiety of wondering, first of all, am I going to get to sleep tonight? Or is it going to be a horrible night? There's the anxiety of thinking, how on earth am I going to be able to cope with looking after my child tomorrow, or if you're working, being able to get on with a job, or looking after the other kids tomorrow if I feel like rubbish the following day. So it's the act of trying to go to sleep that sometimes increases anxiety. And those distraction techniques will often help, because then you're not focused on going to sleep. Your mind is taken elsewhere. Interestingly, a lot of people with insomnia will say, well, look, you know, when I'm sitting on the sofa and I'm watching TV, I'll often doze off on the sofa. But as soon as I get into bed and I don't have any distractions, I will lie awake, my brain will start whirring, my head will start buzzing, and I will be simply unable to sleep. And that's a very good illustration of that phenomenon.
And when we do feel like rubbish, when we're sleep deprived, is there anything that can make us feel better? Because obviously, as new parents, we will be sleep deprived. I remember there were days... Well, I literally felt like I didn't sleep, and I think, how am I going to function? But actually, I kind of functioned just about.
Yeah.
And that sort of anxiety I had about not being able to function was actually just making life harder when it didn't really need to be. But is there anything when we've had one of those terrible nights' sleep that will just help us get through the day? I mean, caffeine? Or is that a bad thing?
Well, I think caffeine certainly provides a temporary stimulant effect. It obviously has its downsides. And what a lot of people don't appreciate is how long caffeine lasts in your system. So the half-life of caffeine is fairly long. If you drink enough of it, even if you try and limit it to earlier on in the day, there will still be some caffeine circulating in your system. So I think the key thing is to use caffeine judiciously. And then the rest of it is rather boring. It's things like exercise.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's fresh air. Light in particular is very good at having an alerting response. So, you know, sometimes that in the UK can be rather difficult, especially in the depths of winter. But exposing yourself to external light can be rather helpful as well.
And those lights that people have that sort of simulate bright daylight when it is a sort of gloomy day in England,
yeah.
Are those helpful to have by your desk, for example?
Well, I think there is certainly a great deal of evidence that they help, for example, if you've got what's termed a circadian rhythm disorder. So if, for example, you're one of those individuals whose body clock is shifted, then we will, in clinical practice, use these bright lights. And they do simulate natural sunlight rather well and can be useful in terms of exerting a stimulating effect. I think once again, you know, as with things like caffeine, it's the timing that is also important. So what you don't want to be doing is you don't want to be exposing yourself to these light boxes late on in the evening, because what that tends to do is it tends to shift your internal body clock back. So it makes your brain want to go to sleep later than you otherwise would and wake up later than you otherwise would, which is a really very bad thing if your baby is going to bed at 8 p.m. and waking up rather early, because essentially then what you're successfully doing is sleep depriving yourself even more.
Yeah. And so if you were wanting to aim to get to bed at, say, 9:30, 10, when would you stop drinking caffeine, and when not too much caffeine, obviously.
Yeah.
And when would you sort of start limiting that exposure to bright lights? What sort of time?
So we generally tend to recommend that people don't drink any caffeine after lunch, particularly if they've had a lot. With regard to light exposure, probably, you know, you should stop at about 4 or 5 p.m.
So coming on to sleep for our children, which is something that, you know, we absolutely obsess about. I mean, presumably sleep is absolutely fundamental for babies. I mean, they sleep, what, 18 hours a day when they're first born, or even
yes. More than that. We know that there are a number of changes that occur through life, and that a newborn baby will, as you say, spend about 2/3 or more of their day asleep. Interestingly, the stages of sleep also change dramatically. So about half of all sleep in babies is REM sleep, what we know as dreaming sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. Whereas in, you know, for example, adults, I'm not going to say you're in my age because that's making assumptions, my age, probably spend somewhere in the region of about 15 to 20% of their time in REM sleep. So there are changes both in terms of duration and also in terms of sleep architecture. Well, if you look at, for example, kids who have sleep disorders, so conditions like obstructive sleep apnea or other conditions that disrupt sleep, or individuals who are very sleep deprived because they have behavioral sleep issues, then we see a number of different findings, and most of those in children relate to behavior. And I don't think it takes a sleep specialist to tell parents that if your kids are very sleep deprived, there will be changes in behavior. But at their extremes, I know that my pediatric colleagues will sometimes see kids who have been diagnosed or provisionally diagnosed with conditions like ADHD, who actually have a sleep disorder underlying them. And when their sleep disorder is treated, their ADHD in inverted commas improves as well. And it's very clear that, sleep-restricted kids and teenagers will, for example, perform less well at school. And we see that particularly in teenagers, particularly those teenagers who are going to bed very late and, you know, would like to wake up very late, but don't because they have to get up for school. So there are some sort of broad implications for optimizing nighttime sleep in children.
Do you think you can learn or be taught to sleep well?
Well, sleep is a learned pattern of behavior, and I think that learning of good sleep is really the basis for a huge industry of, you know, baby sleep experts who go to people's houses and charge them large amounts of money to teach their babies to sleep. You know, of course, there is a whole issue surrounding the behaviors that children learn with regard to sleep. But, you know, one shouldn't lose sight of the fact that, you know, we all have genetic variants or other aspects of our physical and mental health that influence our sleep, and those will influence the sleep of children as well, particularly slightly older children. But yes, absolutely, it's a behavior that can be learned.
And I suppose too, you know, if you can get into a sort of good routine, because sleep, you know, sleep tends to thrive with routine. Going to bed at a similar time every night is quite important, isn't it, for the
absolutely, you know, I talked a little bit about those associations between bed and sleep that influence people with insomnia. For children, that's also really important. The fact that they know that their sleeping environment is a place of relaxation, of calmness, of sleep, whereby that if they exhibit certain behaviors, that they're not going to be rewarded for those behaviors. So we're now talking about younger children. Because, you know, children learn by reward, and to some degree punishment. Now, punishment in the sleep context doesn't mean, you know, physical punishment, but certainly not giving certain behaviors attention as a punishment is something that's really important. And my pediatric colleagues will be rather rigid about the advice that they give. Now, I think any parent will have heard of things like controlled crying and things like that. And there are a range of ways in which those can be put in place so that actually children are calmed, they're soothed, but they're also rewarded for sleeping well, and they're not rewarded for, you know, getting up, throwing tantrums, crying in the middle of the night. It's about making sure that that everything that you as a parent do engenders that association between bed and sleeping well, sleeping through the night. Now, it's easier said than done. And, you know, yet despite the fact that I know the theory, I'm not sure that I put it in practice with my children particularly well. But at least having knowledge of the kinds of things that you should be doing might at least inform you.
And that consistency, I suppose, is really important. And I mean, I remember reading something and they said, you know, when your child wakes up in the middle of the night, just don't engage with them, which you know, people interpreted as being really cruel. How could you not look at your child and maintain eye contact with your child? But essentially that for them is stimulation, and stimulation is the last thing they need when they're trying to, you know, go to sleep.
And indeed, even an inconsistent response can sometimes be rewarding. So if you do that, you know, 50% of the time, but the other 50% of the time you don't engage with them, then they will still learn that actually if they get up in the middle of the night and start screaming, there's a pretty good chance that you will come in and you'll start engaging with them and playing with them. Now, obviously, there's a balance to be had, because as a parent, you don't, you know, personally, I don't feel terribly comfortable. And now I'm talking as a parent rather than talking as a sleep specialist. I don't feel particularly comfortable with letting my child scream for hours and hours through the night. But, you know, there's a difference between going in and making sure that they're safe and making sure that they know that you're there, from actually kind of properly engaging with them and picking them up and, you know, talking to them, et cetera, et cetera.
And reading a story to them.
Yes.
Or letting them get in your bed.
Indeed. Indeed. That is the death knell for your sleep.
Yes. Yes. So the other death knell is if your child has nightmares, which seems to be relatively common. Is it, or is that just my perception?
Yeah, it's very common. I think there are two issues with regard to nightmares. So what a lot of people refer to as nightmares are actually something called sleep terrors. And sleep terrors are a phenomenon whereby children, and by the way, this is not uncommon, it affects about 5% of kids, will at certain stages in their development, suddenly in the middle of the night, get up, they'll look extremely distressed, they'll be screaming and shouting, they'll be engaging with you. And then after a little while, they'll go back to sleep, and they won't remember any of that. Essentially, what this represents is a form of sleepwalking, a condition called a non-REM parasomnia. And actually for them, they don't recall it. It doesn't do any damage. It's actually much more traumatic for the parent than it is for the child, because the child wakes up in the morning, is told, oh, you did this and this, and has no recollection of it whatsoever. So these kinds of behaviors arise from very deep sleep, from those deepest stages of what we term non-REM sleep. Nightmares are, you know, what we experience also in adulthood. These are unpleasant dreams of a narrative structure from which we wake and we recall them. And they are a normal part of growing up. They're a normal part of learning. They're a normal part of understanding the world. We think that actually dreams are important in a number of ways. They're important in terms of understanding our environment, understanding the world that we live in, but they're also important in emotional processing. And so it's not surprising that children, as they grow up, will have some distressing dreams whereby the emotional content of those dreams is sufficient to cause them to fully wake up. They don't in and of themselves necessarily represent anything wrong with that child, unless they're very thematic, unless they're related to some sort of traumatic experience, in which case we would refer to that as PTSD associated nightmares. And, you know, really it is about reassurance and about trying to optimize other aspects of sleep to try and make sure that their sleep is as good quality as possible.
Because I mean, what you don't want is a child that's frightened of going to sleep because they are anticipating these really unpleasant nightmares.
Yeah.
In terms of talk, is it important to get your child to talk about them? And, you know, very often it's the monster under the bed. It's something that is absolutely not going to happen.
Yeah.
How important is it to reassure them that's not going to happen? Or do we need to acknowledge that what they're dreaming about is scary and they're not being silly to find it scary?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the best person to talk to, because the issue that I have is that I see predominantly adults rather than children. I know that for my pediatric colleagues, what they often say is it's about reassurance. It's about making them feel calm. You know, I think by and large, kids are not going to be easily dismissed. And I think certainly acknowledging the fact that these are scary, but also acknowledging the fact that these are not real phenomena is important. The most important thing is that for the vast majority of children, they grow out of these. You know, things settle with time. And in the heat of the moment, it's very easy to think, oh my God, this is what my life is going to be like for the next 15 years because my kid is going to have these dreams for the next 15 years and I'm going to be in a terrible pickle. But actually, as with all things in parenthood, for the vast majority of individuals, this will pass too.
Mm. And does CBT work for children or people that are having sort of nightmares and night terrors?
Yeah, CBT for insomnia certainly works. It's about causing a reduction in that hypervigilant state. And the reason why we think that hypervigilance also impacts on nightmares is because if you are hypervigilant and it disrupts the quality of your sleep, it makes it much more likely that you're going to be in a slightly aroused or vigilant state during dreaming as well. So you're much more likely to wake up in these situations. And, you know, other things that I know that my pediatric colleagues often recommend is listening to mindfulness-based apps, for example, with their children in order to reduce that level of hyperarousal, to induce that feeling of calmness, of soothing, of reassurance at night. And they will often point to particular apps to be used at night or in the evening alongside their parents to try and facilitate that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And finally, sleepwalking, which I know is quite common. What should you do with a sleepwalking child? Should you wake them up or just take them back to bed?
Well, there is this old wives' tale that it's dangerous to wake up a sleepwalking person. And I think that that comes from a few cases in adulthood of people who have extreme sleepwalking, who as a result of being woken up and being quite confused will have a violent response. Actually, in children, that's not really a major concern at all. And all you really do by waking up a sleepwalking child is you end up having a awake but confused child on your hands. So actually guiding them back to bed and soothing them back to sleep is perhaps the most useful thing that you can do. It's also, you know, once again, I stress the fact that as with many things in childhood, it often passes. So we know that about 20% of kids will sleepwalk on more than one occasion. And about 40% of kids will sleepwalk at least once. Actually, that persisting into adulthood is pretty rare. Only about 1 or 2% of adults sleepwalk. So for the vast majority of individuals, there will be a phase during which they sleepwalk or have these night terrors, and then they will settle down on their own, usually without any major intervention at all.
Well, apart from the people that I read about in your book, the lady who would go and sleepwalk and drive her car around while she was asleep.
Yes, well, it keeps me in work, the fact that it continues to persist in a few individuals. But these are the minority, the vast minority.
Yeah, and that's why they make such extraordinary stories, is that you're as so unusual. Guy, thank you so much. It's been so fascinating talking to you. I know this has been massively helpful for lots of people listening. Guy's books, The Nocturnal Brain, Nightmares, Neuroscience, and The Secret World of Sleep is brilliant. I read it and was absolutely fascinated. It was quite a lot of self-diagnosis. And his newest book, The Man Who Tasted Words, Inside the Strange and Startling World of Our Senses, is out now.
Marina, can I just tell you a quick anecdote? Yeah. So my 12-year-old daughter at the time read that book, and she came down from reading it and said, "Oh, Dad, I think I've got restless leg syndrome, insomnia, narcolepsy, and Klein-Levin syndrome." So you're not alone in self-diagnosing.
I was reading this thinking, it's me. I have all these issues.
I shall tell my daughter.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your time today, Guy. And thank you all for downloading this episode of The Parenthood. You can subscribe, rate, and review wherever you found this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram. I'm at marina.fogel. But in the meantime, Guy and me, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.